0036, Mary Kay Sulzer versus Mary Suzanne Diedrich. Arguing on behalf of Mary Kay Sulzer is Stephen Jelinek, is it?
Jelinek.
Okay, counsel, you're up.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good afternoon, Justices. May it please the Court, my name is Attorney Steve Jelinek. I'm here representing the plaintiff, respondent, cross-appellant petitioner in this case, Ms. Mary Kay Sulzer, who is the first wife in this case. Seated here to my right is Attorney C. Michael Hausman, who will be handling the last 5 minutes of our argument in the rebuttal section. I'd like to let the Court know that we are very pleased to be here today and thank them for the opportunity to argue our positions in this high forum. Two issues are basically before the Court today. The first issue is, what is the correct allocation for appreciation and interest, which we like to call investment experience, which is a more inclusive term, on Sulzer's half share of the marital portion of Fred's pensions that are now under the control of Ms. Diedrich? Number two, what processes will need to take place for Ms. Sulzer to realize this amount? This case presents a unique set of facts this Court will most likely not see again. But the premise behind our position is simple. Sulzer and Fred were married on September 25, 1976. They were divorced in September of 1989. The language specifically regarding the pensions in the judgment of divorce that was entered in September 1989 states that the parties will divide equally all of Fred's interests in the retirement, pension, profit sharing, or deferred compensation benefits to the Wisconsin retirement system or the state of Wisconsin. It is the parties' intent to have these benefits divided as to their balance of the date of divorce, September 6, 1989, by a qualified domestic relations order, or an order of the Court having similar effect.
Did the parties enter into this by themselves, or were they forced into it by the Court?
They were not forced into it by the Court. They had it was actually coming from a default to force proceeding where their wishes of having an equal division of Fred's pension was put on the record, much like in a default to force hearing where each attorney asks these questions, or these are wishes, is this your intent?
So there is no dispute. There is no dispute before it, I take it then, that the intent of the parties was to divide both the deferred comp as well as the pension 50-50.
That is an accurate statement. And we look at, when it says equally, we interpret that to mean 50%. We don't interpret that to be a lump sum amount of money. And the trial court interpreted it that way as well. And the more restrictive interpretation that's set forth in Dietrich's briefs state that there was nothing else considered at that time, that it was only the amount as of the day of divorce. The Court of Appeals also agreed with us that it was something more.
Well, given that that's the party's intent, what's the problem?
The problem is that on the day of divorce, the pension could not be divided through a QDRO. It could not be divided through any order of the Court.
But why is that a problem?
That was a problem because...
I mean, she couldn't get it then, but at some point she was going to get it when he retired or whatever. Why is that a... Is there a legal problem there? I mean, I realize that they couldn't divide it at that time, but I couldn't divide my pension right now either. Well, I guess with a QDRO or whatever I could.
If you retired, maybe.
Yeah, right, if I retired.
Well, what occurred is that Ms. Sulzer was left somewhat in limbo. After Fred's death, no orders were ever entered dividing this pension. One order was entered by Judge Hassan, by Judge Zick in 1993, ordering Fred to pay out, or when he takes his distribution, to pay it into the clerk of courts. So then the clerk of courts then could take this money and divide it as they see fit. After he died, you could not enter a QDRO at all for these amounts.
Is the nature of the agreement that was entered into at the time of the divorce, is that in the nature of a contract between the two parties?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. It was made in a...
It would be pretty easy if we decided that it was a contract, wouldn't it?
Well, if the contract stated a certain dollar amount, I guess it would be easier. What the contract, it wasn't a contract. It was made in open court. It wasn't something that was a marital settlement agreement that then came about.
Wasn't it stipulated by the parties?
It was.
And then approved by the judge?
Yes, you're correct, Chief Justice. It was.
And the problem is that we know what was there, but we don't, the law would not allow it. In other words, it was illegal, or it lacked the legality to be able to do it at that time, right? That's the difficulty. In other words, you could not get the money, and the judge went along, as you're saying, this was an agreement between the parties, so the judge went along with the intent of the parties?
Absolutely. But the intent of the parties, and the parties did know that there was going to be some eventualities that need to take place in the future for this division to occur. And with those eventualities, they need to realize the nature of the property is something that kept growing in the WRS accounts. We view Fred as somewhat of a fiduciary or someone who needs to hold this money in trust. This pension had a hitch to it. This wasn't a pension that was awarded to him completely. I think the Dewey case is a interesting case because that case says, upon a divorce decree, a pension is divided into two separate interests that vest at that moment. And as we view that case to mean is that what happened to Fred's pension is that his interest was completely extinguished and two amounts of money were set up, or two interests that were vested at that moment became into being. And Ms. Sulzer's grew through the normal investment experience of staying in that WRS system. And Fred's grew by that same kind of investment experience, but also by other contributions that he made, other employer contributions.
Mr. Jelinek, is it your position that the 1989 divorce judgment was not at all ambiguous?
I don't believe it was ambiguous. It provided for an equal division, which is 50%. And 50% means 50%.
Well, let me ask you this. Was there any deferred compensation program for the Wisconsin retirement system?
Yes, there was. That was administered by the Copeland companies, I believe. And that was also intended to be split 50%.
Well, your opposing counsel seems to suggest that that was something through the city of Waukesha.
It was through the city of Waukesha. I think the court needs to realize that the bulk of the money is in the Wisconsin retirement system. And when this action was brought about, we included all those amounts together to kind of design one giant corpus. And as I understand it, that deferred compensation plan was also able to be divided, and through the exhibits at trial and the testimony of the expert that was uncontested, she was able to actually create that investment experience for those monies.
Well, let me ask you a hypothetical question. If you had two parties, one of whom was a state employee, who were divorced in 1980, and they divided his pension, let's say, in 1980, would it be possible now to issue a quadro to divide those pensions?
I'm uncertain of the law reaching as back as 1980, but I know there are provisions that would have provided for a QDRO or a similar type of order to be instituted to divide this pension from 1982 to 1990, which is basically the time period in which we fall into. However, since the change in law that the public service statutes the DETF cited in their letter to us why they would not divide the pensions, stated that any QDRO would need to be received to do that from after 1998. And Fred had already died in 1995, and they also have a rule stating that if the participant has passed, they will honor no QDRO. So we are caught here in a no-man's land where there was a law change. The act that was passed was originally prospective. Then it went back a few years, and then they took it back all the way to 1990. They also had another statute that then covered from 1982 to 1990. I'm unsure what would happen before 1980.
Counsel, I need help in focusing on this case because I think this case can be wide or can be narrow, it can be simple, complex, and I need your assistance. You indicate the first issue is what's the correct allocation for appreciation interest? And to me, that's kind of, you know, what's the right answer? Which leads me to want more focus. What is the precise legal question or questions that are contained in this more umbrella-like statement of issue?
I would say that the more precise legal question would be, why shouldn't the money be paid over, or why shouldn't appreciation in interest or investment experience of this money accrue until it is actually paid over to Ms. Salzer? Accrue until she realizes that interest.
Are you contesting the vehicle of payment designed by the Court of Appeals? Specifically, are you contesting the validity of a constructive trust in this case?
No, I'm not. We're very happy with a constructive trust.
And as I understand the Court of Appeals decision, it allows for appreciation in interest up until, I think, February 8, 1995, the date of the death of Mr. Dietrich.
Correct. Yes.
And you're here because although you like the Court of Appeals decision, constructive trust, you didn't like the trial court's revised decision of a money judgment. You're happy with a constructive trust, but you're here because you want some kind of interest and or appreciation from February 8, 1995, to the date of payment. Is that why you're here?
Absolutely.
That's what you're requesting. That's what you're after. And what legal reasoning would allow you to get that?
Well, the Washington case states, and this was a Supreme Court case, states that the courts should attempt to bring about the party's intent. As we discussed earlier, the party's intent was to divide these pensions equally. And in the Washington case, you're dealing with a lump sum payment. We weren't dealing with a 50% percentage. And the Washington, what the Court of Appeals decision does is effectively awards Ms. Dietrich 7 years or 8 years now of appreciation and interest on the vested share that Ms. Salzer owns.
And isn't that the simplest and perhaps the correct result? Assuming in 1989, the date that they entered into this agreement, let's just take one aspect of this. Let's say there's $100,000 in the deferred compensation fund. So they agreed that $50,000 was hers, $50,000 was his. Now, it's a very simple calculation to figure out what has happened to that pot of money since then in terms of the investment. It's probably gone up, maybe compounded 5% a year. Let's assume 5% a year. Why isn't the court just taking the simple solution, saying she's entitled to $50,000 plus compound interest of 5% per year up until today?
I think that would be an appropriate way to look at it.
Inappropriate.
However, that
sounds so simple, and that's why I keep thinking I'm missing something here, because that seems to me to carry out the intent of the parties. It's fair.
I agree. The intent of the parties was to have an equal division of the pensions. And when the Court of Appeals allows Ms. Dietrich what we like to classify as a windfall of the investment experience or appreciation and interest earned on Ms. Salzer's vested share, separate share, then it It does. It contravenes the intent of the parties and the intent of the divorce decree.
But you don't. You're agreeing with Justice Babich, but I didn't read your brief in your early your argument thus far as agreeing with him at all. So I need again help with clarification. Maybe I misunderstood his question. I understood his question to be, hey, look, the divorce was in 1989. So what's so difficult about this 5% interest from 1989?
And, or whatever the experience of the deferred comp fund was.
Okay. Are you agreeing with interest since 1989? Do you want interest and appreciation since 1989? And when does it stop?
I want appreciation and interest. However, I think that's tied into what I've been calling investment experience. And it is something that our expert was able to prove at trial by simulating the exact same computer program or process that the Wisconsin retirement system invokes to kind of figure out these people's interests. So,
are you willing to take the losses, too?
Absolutely. We realize that when a percentage is awarded, and this was a holding in a case that I didn't cite in our briefs, it's a Court of Appeals case, Taylor v. Taylor, and it states that when a percentage is awarded through the divorce decree, then the percentage is a experience, the percentage deals with both the growth and the loss. And we realize that since August 2001, with the events that have occurred with the economy, it may have taken somewhat of a nosedive, or it wouldn't have grown as greatly as it did the previous 5 years. So yes, we are prepared to take into account any losses that have occurred since.
Part of this was in the variable, right?
Yes, part of it was in the variable.
But as we've been reading, and that the variable fund has not done very well in the last couple of years.
Absolutely.
So you're including that, and you understand? Okay.
Absolutely.
Wasn't this money removed from the retirement system after death? It was rolled over, wasn't it?
I don't believe it was rolled over. I believe what happened was a change in control, a change of hats. Fred passed on. There was no distribution ever made. If a distribution was made to Ms. Dietrich, I believe we would have had an easier time somehow getting a hold of it. The WRS plan is basically the safest place for this money in Ms. Dietrich's eyes because they are governed by the statutes that don't allow for execution or attachment.
So how is she paid? Is she paid monthly, annually, or not paid at all?
What we're looking for is for her to elect a lump sum payment. A lump sum payment?
You want her to take a lump sum payment and then give it to your client?
Give it to our client minus the tax ramifications.
To her?
Correct.
Well, the Wisconsin Retirement System can figure that out for you in 10 minutes, can't they?
I agree, Justice.
But, counsel, paragraph 17 of the Court of Appeals opinion says, hey, you can't do that. Because upon Mr. Dietrich's death, these monies are no longer retirement benefits, but are survivorship benefits. So the character of the benefits change. All that your client would be entitled to are the benefits, that is, the appreciation and interest, but as of the date of death. And nothing more. That's what they held as a legal conclusion. What's wrong with that legal conclusion based on the premise that the character of the benefits has changed?
We don't believe, perhaps the character of the benefits have changed, but they have remained in the exact same variable accounts and fixed accounts, the exact same investments as Fred had them. They were not moved at all from any of the investments. They've continued. When you look at the statements that our expert used to put together these numbers, the month before Fred's death, the same exact statement was issued after his death. So these amounts did continue to earn appreciation and interest.
Let me rephrase that question. What effect, if any, should his death and the change from retirement benefits to survivorship benefits play in your legal analysis?
It would not really have much of an effect on Ms. Salzer's vested share. She was given a separate property interest in that account the day the divorce decree was entered, and that's what the Dewey case states. And if Fred dies or he retires or he withdraws it, so long as that money is in the WRS account or in the same accounts, our share is, Ms. Salzer's share, is still independent of his. Regardless if he's died or you want to call it a survivorship benefit, the evidence shown at trial that was very carefully put together showed that this money wasn't staying stagnant. Her share was growing. And that's where the trial court agreed with the $169,000 as of August 2001.
Your argument is that you can trace these funds.
Very easily. And I think Justice Babich agrees with me on that.
Regardless of, well, we don't know whether he agrees with you or not, but regardless of whether, if you're talking about constructive trust, you're in effect talking about one of the aspects of constructive trust is tracking and tracing funds. So if you can trace that dollar or a pot from A to B to D to Z, and it hasn't been commingled, et cetera, then that's what you want.
Absolutely.
17, the Court of Appeals says in paragraph 17, that's why they're not giving appreciation. In 18, they say they're not giving you interest because you delayed getting the money.
Okay. Let me address the first part of 17. Appreciation and interest is typically awarded on a lump sum amount. And that's what Washington dealt with, and that's what many of these cases deal with, a lump sum amount allocating appreciation interest. Again, I want to stress that we believe a 50% interest was made here. And if we talk appreciation interest, if we call it tracing of a 50% amount, that's what we believe needs to be done. Using regular post-interest or post-judgment interest kind of ideals to decide if in a wrongful retention and that sort of thing to decide what Ms. Salzer's share is not appropriate here. It's a 50% share. And if it's up or it's down, it's 50% of the marital portion, not of the entire pension, of the marital portion as of September 1989.
Did he contribute additional sums after the divorce into his retirement fund?
I believe he did.
So it's 50% of the amount that was in there then, but it will be less than 50% now.
It is 50% or half of the marital portion as it stood on September 1989.
And plus earnings. Plus or minus earnings, I take it.
Correct. Absolutely.
Counsel, is it your position that a General Motors pension is exactly the same as a state of Wisconsin pension?
No, it is not. Especially in this case where a QDRO could be used for a General Motors pension and not for our pension.
So if they're not exactly the same, why would there be a vested interest in the pension at the time of divorce as there was in the Dewey case?
Well, the premise that it's not that far out there that the premise of a pension that is divided by a judgment of divorce is extinguishes all past property interests and begins two vested separate interests, I think can still be applied to a WRS pension. It is nowadays, in the present time, when QDROs are available. And
my problem with your case is this. It's not with the equities of your case. I think your equities are very strong. But I don't understand how the divorce judgment that divided the pensions in 1989 was lawful. I don't understand how it has ever been made lawful. I can understand some wrongdoing on the part of Fred with respect to the deferred compensation because he was ordered to change that. But he wasn't ordered to change the WRS pension.
He was not.
You point to one, and I could go along with that, because he defied a court order. But I don't see how you get around the other one.
Well, I think illegality is an incorrect term for what occurred. I think it was there's always some sort of desire to bring about a stipulation or an agreement to bring about finality to these divorces. The court, Fred, Ms. Salzer, knew there were going to be future eventualities like a QDRO or something else that needed to occur. I think we needed to get back to what the party's intent was. It was to divide it equally. And as stated, talking about the illegality later in these rules that rule the DETF, they did make provisions for people from 1982 to 1989 and 1990 forward until QDROs are now available for the WRS. So to argue that it was illegal at the time, I think this administrative body has now realized that they needed to make changes to fit inequities.
The legislature made changes in 1998 to go back to 1982.
Yes.
But Fred had been dead for 3 years.
Yes, he had. And that's, I think, with the unique facts presented in this case, it doesn't disturb the idea that there was an intent to divide the pensions equally. And we're just looking to get that, to realize that intent 12 years later. And
Justice Bradley.
In response to Justice Prosser's question about do you treat this state retirement benefit quadra the same as you would under General Motors, it seems to me an argument is made that, look, we're dealing with a state retirement benefit that is subject to administrative regulation and state statute. According to the ETF, once Mr. Diedrich died, then, and I'm looking at 480 of the appendix, their letter explaining all of this, then there is no longer any interest of the deceased in the Wisconsin retirement system. He no longer has any interest whatsoever, and that money doesn't belong to him, and it doesn't belong to his estate. The only what that money belongs to who's been designated as the beneficiary. And they cite, of course, Wisconsin Stat 40.23 and 40.24. So how can you continue to trace the growth of the retirement system and ask for that appreciation and interest when it no longer, according to the statutes, is a state retirement system?
Well,
the deceased no longer, nor his estate, have any interest in it.
I would argue that his 50% interest, that according to Dewey, his sole and separate property, was moved on to Ms. Diedrich. And that's correct. He didn't continue to own it. Ms. Salzer's 50% vested interest that was invented on the day of the divorce continued.
So that your argument trumps 40.23 and 40.24 of the statutes, which purportedly say, I haven't reviewed them, I have them earlier, but which purportedly say that any interest in the retirement system is extinguished and now it's just a survivorship interest.
Well, Ms. Salzer had equitable title to her 50% share. The court has likened the effectuation of a QDRO to the passing over of title to real estate that was awarded in divorce, or, excuse me, a deed to real estate that was awarded in divorce, or a title to a car. These were almost ministerial things that needed to be done. But on the day of divorce, Ms. Salzer received equitable title to the 50% share pursuant to Dewey. And all we're looking for now is for legal title to be passed to Ms. Salzer.
Justice Babbage.
I really am very unaware of this area of the law, and so I'm confused as to why you even need a constructive trust in this matter. It seems to me that if it were my case, I would probably be arguing, hey, at the time of the divorce, she took 50%, in essence, a lien. She had a lien on his, on both of these pots that she could assert any time she wants. Why do you need a constructive trust here?
Well, the nature of the property of a lien is something that doesn't necessarily gain appreciation and interest. So that's something I don't think we would look for. A lien is a set amount of money unless...
I'm just trying to get educated. Why constructive trust? Why... seems to me to be doing things awfully hard.
Well, a constructive trust recognizes a right. It recognizes that someone else owns equitable title while someone else has legal title to that. And in this case, we feel there was some sort of wrongful retention, not necessarily by Ms. Dietrich as much as Fred. And a constructive trust is a way to say, hey, this is our money, and when it gets paid out, we don't need to... as long as we impose the correct amount of money in it, there isn't further proceedings that need to take place, really, to satisfy that right. And that was our problem with the money judgment originally, is that a money judgment didn't really realize that we have an interest in this pot of money that was established through the tenants of Dewey.
And you want a court order, it seems to me, ordering her to remove from this benefit X amount of dollars and pay it over to you immediately, less tax consequences to her.
Yes, that's what we're asking for.
But why do you need a constructive trust? Why not? Is that just the gimmick to get to the order?
Absolutely. And a constructive trust, I mean, the essence of a constructive trust is that someone's holding our money and they have a duty to us. And until...
Pay out to you.
Exactly. And until it's paid out, that constructive trust should stay imposed.
And you can do that because you've got personal jurisdiction over her.
Well, another case I cited was the Lindsay case. And in the Lindsay case, there was a pension for a husband that was going to be paid out at some point. The husband wanted to elect to take an annuity. The wife wanted to elect to take a lump sum payment. And the court decided that the trial court had the power to order the husband to make the election against his wishes, despite that he had discretion in the matter, so long as it's not in contravention of the plan's policies, and he is the one under the plan who can make that election.
And she can under this plan?
I believe so.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Houseman will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Brendel, representing Mary Susan Dietrich.
My name, may it please the court, my name is John Brendel. I represent the Mary Susan Dietrich, who is technically the appellant petitioner initially in this action. I will try and answer a couple of the questions that I heard being posed to counsel. The constructive trust is a necessity in order for them, that is Mrs. Sulzer, to reach Mary Susan Dietrich. Mary Susan Dietrich was not a party to that contract that was entered into at the time of the stipulation. She married him some 3 or 4 years later. And therefore, it has always been our argument that could not be a constructive trust and they could not reach her. Because in order for there to be a constructive trust, it is clear that always been the law that you have to show some kind of unconscionable conduct or fault. And our position has always been, and as has every judge who's appeared on this case so far, has indicated that certainly Mary Susan Dietrich was not at fault in any way or regard. That was Judge Hassan's ruling over and over on his opinion, and it also appears to be the case here. And when we're talking about issues before the court, well, it's even the defense starts out here where significant wrongdoing is established to support the imposition of a constructive trust and so forth. They acknowledge...
I think, at least from my own perception, I don't believe that she's done anything wrong either. But if she takes money that isn't hers, then eventually she has done something wrong. And it seems to me that at least here, the intent of the parties is so clear that 50% go to her, to Ms. Schultzer, and 50% remain his, that to do anything other than carry out that intent would simply be unfair. How do you respond to that? I haven't been able to get past that since I first started reviewing this case a week ago.
Well, the 50% that they were talking about at the time of the divorce, and you have to understand these are two people standing before the court getting a divorce, and the transcript clearly indicates that at one point she wanted half of his pension program, which under 4008 was improper. A pension program was obviously a fringe benefit designed by Waukesha and the state of Wisconsin to keep the fireman on duty. They give him an incentive for his own good. That section of 4008 is clearly against assignments, either in law or in equity.
But what am I missing here? Do you admit that that the fair thing for this court to do would be to say 50% as of the date of death, or as the date of divorce, plus or minus any earnings since then on that 50%?
I do not agree that there should be any earnings or appreciation on that at the time. In fact, our position has been, as we set forth in our briefs, that in view of the fact that there was a violation of this section 4008, which is designed to protect the firemen, this agreement should never have been entered into.
But you agree that at the time of the divorce, it was Mr. Was it Schultzer?
Dietrich.
It was Mr. Dietrich's intent to give 50% to Ms. Schultzer.
Right.
And if, in fact, they had carried it out on that very day, Ms. Schultzer would have had one half of the pension if it had been able to be carried out on that day. She'd have been taken half the pot of the pension, half the pot of the deferred comp, and gone on her merry way and made either earnings or lost money, depending on how wisely she invested it. Why doesn't this court have at least equity powers to put her into that position? And why isn't that the fair result?
Because if you're trying to find out what the intent of the parties were, as I understand even counsel for Mrs. Schultzer said, the intent of the parties was never to give her 50% all the while before she retires or some 15 or 20 years later, such as in the Washington case. His intent at the time was, okay, you can have half that fund. Let's get it over with. Let's be done with it. On the other premise, you've got to assume that he was planning, if he actually knew that you couldn't pass out the money, you'd have to assume, contrarily then, that he was planning to be a partner with her for the next 15 or 20 years, and when the money comes out of the pension fund and actually retires, that he's going to issue her a check directly.
But there
could not be a direct connection between the Wisconsin Retirement Fund, because they won't handle it. They did not see this. And the truth of the matter is that this lawsuit was started at least a year and a half or 2 years before the law was even passed permitting quadros. And it's 3 years past Fred's death.
Counsel, let me just ask you. So Justice Babich's question is, all right, we knew at the time of the divorce what 50% was. I mean, that's a known figure. Now, if I understand opposing counsel, he is saying, all right, you start out with that figure, and then you can track that regardless of what Mr. Dietrich put in prior to his death. In other words, but that 50%, there was an X number of dollars there, and then there was appreciation that is attributed to only that 50%, and that's what they want. That 50% that was there at the time of the divorce and any appreciation, or I should say, and appreciation, if any, but we assume that there was some appreciation. And that can be followed actuarially for the lifetime from 1989 up until the present date. There's no taking of any other monies that would belong to Mr. Dietrich. So in other words, you can follow that, and that was the intent, right?
It was never Fred's, I'm sure, never Fred's intent to add appreciation, et cetera, at the time. He wanted the divorce.
You mean it was his intent to use her money for his benefit?
No.
Because the stipulation said that the value was to be as of the date of the divorce.
Right.
It's repeated twice.
That's exactly right.
Fred had in the back of his mind that he was going to give her 50% of that value, but he was going to keep all the interest and the earnings on that money?
He and she, I believe, were both of the mind that they could get the money out immediately.
Well, they couldn't. We know that. So the point is that...
They couldn't even go into this kind of an agreement under the law.
So you would say, are you saying that she would get nothing then?
I believe that at the best they have a stipulation, which is a contract, such as Justice said, and that her gripe or her claim should be with Fred Dietrich, not with his widow. It's this long time after they get married. She had nothing to do with that divorce.
Yes.
Didn't even know him then. And yet she's been put to all this problem and expense, and even winding up in the Supreme Court of the United States, and all she thought she had was marrying a fireman, and she's a policeman.
You're not there yet, but you could get there. But let's put it this way. We're talking about equity, we're talking about law, but we knew, we being yourself and opposing counsel, and the parties knew what that figure was at the time of the divorce. So if there was $100,000, I'm just going to give hypothetically, there was $100,000, each got $50,000. Now the $50,000 for Ms. Sulzer could not be touched because of the legal concerns, the legal ramifications. It couldn't be done, as you stated. But the $50,000 was still there. And that had interest accruing, and that was a part that would not, you could separate that from what your client would get.
It's more complicated than that.
I will say that.
Because there are other rules that come into effect. For example, Fred Dietrich never got to be over 50 years old. And one of the requirements are that if you die before 50 or you quit before 50, there's different formulas that you can get. In the case of he was only 49, in that instance, he's entitled only to his own contributions. He would have been probably doubled in amount if he had lived another year or so.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a calculation. As far as Waukesha is concerned, if you can't even get to your money unless you retire or you die. In his case, he got it through death. But if had he left there, he would only get back his own contributions, nothing more. Because those are certain requirements.
Yes.
And those requirements have to be recalculated, frankly. I don't think we know exactly how to get there. But some way or another, yes, I think we could come to a conclusion, as you're suggesting.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. But I'm saying the same thing. What happens if, for example, Fred Dietrich named the Boys and Girls Club of America as beneficiary? Will we be standing here trying to get the money back from the Boys and Girls Club and give it to Mrs. Sulzer? I think not. And as was mentioned, this...
Well, Mrs. Sulzer, you might.
She might be here, but...
Counsel, if I understood your brief, your first position is that Ms. Sulzer gets nothing. This was an illegal contract, couldn't make it, and that all she's doing is still fighting with the decedent. That she should get nothing. Is that right? Your major position?
Yes.
Your primary
position? It's because, not because I'm trying to be unfair, but because there's no way that it should come from this lady's money, and it became her money when Fred died. There's no reason.
She's the named beneficiary.
Yes, and when they got married, they each switched beneficiary requests on his Wisconsin retirement fund and on her retirement fund. She was a Waukesha policewoman.
Well, may I ask? On the deferred compensation, I think it was in February 1993, Judge Zick ordered Fred to assign half of that deferred compensation to his former wife. And he didn't do it. Now, was that an illegal order by the court, or was it blatant wrongdoing that has to be addressed?
That was against the Copeland plan, as I recall. And there were many things in there showing, again, that the parties only, I think, planned to divide that monies which were in the pot on that day of the divorce. As you mentioned, it's mentioned twice that they specifically refer to the date of divorce. They ignore any appreciation and so forth. But I think they ignored it because they didn't anticipate any appreciation to be added to that. And then they wanted to get the money out. They couldn't get the money out. They had a right to appeal. They didn't use that appeal. It just keeps going on and on. They had a right to go back to court and say, look, you owed me $16,000 or whatever the Copeland plan was, half of that or $8,000. Now I got to get it a different way. He was around then. He was available. She could well have done that. And yet here we are attempting to reward her 12 or 14 years later for sitting back and not appealing to the Wisconsin Retirement Fund, not going to the court and saying, I have a problem, I can't get that money. Fred never, there's been no evidence or proof that Fred violated anything. And in fact, he appears to be, from all of the indications of the transcripts, to be most cooperative. There's no evidence anybody gave him any papers to do anything. Yes, I don't think Judge Zick had the right to do that. And we have to remember also that these were ex-party orders. Fred was not a party to this. Suddenly, it was drafted, no doubt, by her attorneys at the time. Neither of us were attorneys involved in the divorce action. But it was something that was drafted by them. And even there, they admit there's no division, there's no particular interest in the property itself. In one of the paragraphs Judge Zick mentioned, contrary to this situation where immediately it becomes a judgment, it was not that was not the case at that time. You have the Washington case, and this has been mentioned. The Washington case was discussing a federal pension, and which was proper at the time to divide. But there's a couple of things even in Chief Justice Abramson's decision that I think are of interest as well. One of which says that the federal government is only interested in how the pensions get paid. They do not that the court awards. Well, Wisconsin did regulate at the time. They wouldn't do it. They would not let any of that pension plan be divided against one of their fire people. So in that sense, it's different. Also, at the time that the Washington case was decided, it was legal to have quadros and to divide pension programs. Back in 1989, when this divorce came about, it was illegal. It was improper. So the equities are not quite the same. And I think another thing that was mentioned was that the divorce law presumes finality, that each party is free to start again, free of the other. And I believe these people had decided at that day, at the sudden moment, that it was apparently lawful to give her half the money and get her over with and then go his own separate way. And that's why I take that position. If there has to be some active wrongdoing shown.
Let me address that active please. Wrongdoing shown. As I understand your first argument, it's this, that Sulzer is owed no money because Dietrich is the beneficiary of the benefits.
Yes.
Period. And no constructive trust can be put on those benefits. Is that correct or is that incorrect as to the characterization of your argument?
My argument is certainly that there's no constructive trust that's available. And I guess the other part would follow then as well.
And the other part being that there's no wrongdoing, or the other part?
No, the other part being that the half that she would have had she been able to get it on the day of the divorce would be absorbed into that if I'm going to be logical and follow through. Correct.
Let me give you a hypothetical that happens on occasion, has happened in our case law, and happens in this setting. The divorce decree provides that the kids shall be maintained as beneficiaries on the life insurance policy. And that's not all that unusual as a provision in the divorce decree. And lo and behold, he remarries and changes the beneficiary to his second wife. He dies. Can the kids have a constructive trust against the second wife for the proceeds of that life insurance?
Actually, that happened.
Happens, I know it does.
And in the decision that I cite in our brief, the court there would not go along and grant it, and he knowingly changed the beneficiary in that case. I think it's Wilharms. In that case, the husband actually changed the beneficiary, and it's something that you're describing very well happened.
I pulled up a case, what is it, the Singer case, which cites actually Wilharms in a footnote. And in Singer, it was, you know, again, the same situation that has occurred in a number of our cases, where it is the kids who are the beneficiaries whose names are changed by the second wife. And this Singer case was after Wilharm, and it cites Wilharm in a footnote. And in footnote 2, the Singer case says, it is not necessary that the person against whom the constructive trust is to be imposed be a wrongdoer or know of the wrongdoing initially, citing Wilharm's 93 with 2nd 679. So I'm not fully persuaded by your argument that just because the second wife wasn't a wrongdoer, that constructive trust cannot be effectuated against those proceeds. How do you respond to that?
Well, you just stated the Singer case indicates that Mary Susan Dietrich may not have to be found to be a wrongdoer. But somebody had to be found to be a wrongdoer, even the Singer case.
In order for a constructive trust to exist initially. It doesn't have to be the second wife, but
right.
For instance, the husband who, and when wrongdoing is kind of a broad phrase. The law of constructive trust has a litany of things. Wrongdoing, fraud, mistake is one of the things. So arguably, you don't have to find fraud, you don't have to find intentional wrongdoing, you can find that he mistakenly changed the beneficiary when he shouldn't have, because the kids should have still have been the beneficiaries under the divorce.
Under constructive fraud, as it exists, at least up to this date, a mistake is not an excuse. It's got to be worse than mistake. It has to be fraudulent or otherwise.
Well, let's look at the definition of constructive trust. Maybe I'm wrong, but my recollection of the few cases that I've read on this indicate that litany that I just went through.
Constructive trust requires that title must pass by actual or constructive fraud, duress, abuse of a confidential relationship. Oh, I stand corrected. The mistake is one. I'm sorry. I didn't think that it included
that.
Okay,
we all can make a mistake.
Commission of a wrong or unconscionable conduct. And there wasn't any mistake in this thing. He changed the beneficiary because he got married and they both switched. When you think of it, there's nothing that he could do. He could not go to Copeland and say, I'm going to change this. I want to do this. They said, no, you can't. That's against our rules. He can't go to the Wisconsin Retirement Fund at the time, as you noted in that letter. They're not going to listen to him. They're not going to do anything that he wants to do. Even if he had gone there and demanded it, they wouldn't do it.
But weren't there two mistakes? The parties themselves made a mistake, and the judge also made a mistake. Let's say that it was an erroneous ruling here.
So did their lawyers make a mistake. They shouldn't have done it in the first place.
Well, but I agree. But I'm just saying, as Justice Bradley pointed out, if mistake, that would allow at least a constructive trust to be considered here, because this was something that happened by mistake. Is that Is that a fair argument?
Well, it was certainly a mistake. I would concur.
Well, are you saying, Mr. Brendel, it seems to me you're saying that if, in fact, you prevail, that I could go into court tomorrow with a divorce and enter into a stipulation with my wife that she gets half of my pension, half of my deferred comp, and then we get divorced, and then I walk, and she doesn't get a penny. Are you saying I can get away with that?
No, I'm saying you're not violating any rules. You're not violating any laws of the state of Wisconsin.
Well, let's say in 1989, let's assume, what could they have done to carry out their intent legally?
Well, you know, there's a difference in the intent between the Washington case, for example, and what happened to these more simple people with less assets. In the Washington case, it's clearly made known, because the amounts are different as to who got what of the pension program, that they were dividing everything equally. And the court, therefore, said that must have been their intent, because they're down to the penny. And all we're sitting here now is they wanted to stay down to the penny.
But your position today, your number one position, seems to be that they couldn't do what they did in 1989, and therefore he's able to, Fred at that time was able to wiggle his fingers at the court and sign this stipulation, knowing that he wouldn't have to pay a nickel.
No, I
suspect
that... Well,
you're saying that she should get nothing.
I said under the constructive trust that I'm in accord with what the Court of Appeals ruled. If they consider that the constructive trust is okay due to the mistake business, which they didn't point out, but if that were so, perhaps the constructive trust then is all right. But if they, once the money got distributed, at the time of Fred's death at the very latest, that should cut it off right there and then, as far as I'm concerned. Basically, I initially, as she said, I either indicated that she should get nothing because of the violation of the and because the constructive trust was not applicable, or two, that she should get the money that she was agreed to take at the time, which was one half of the day of the divorce, and all the prior orders given by ex-party counsel, they prepared them, all seemed to indicate that was the intent of the parties at the time. Now, many, many years later, despite the fact that it was a violation, despite the fact that even at the time this divorce, this action was started in December of 96, I believe, the law hadn't even changed then yet. And yet we're here paying homage to a demand which initially started out to be against the law, that nobody else did, and the law hadn't changed. And now, even after the divorce is in being, Fred's already dead 3 years. The Hassan order never came to him, of course, because he's already dead a month earlier. And she does nothing to rectify it until December of 96, before Christmas. And then a year and a half to 2 years later, in 98, the law, for the first time, by reason of the legislature, allows the interest that was trying to be passed by quadro to exist against the firemen. That's the basic part of the argument. It just seems that it's a windfall, if anything, for Mrs. Sulzer, not for Mrs. Dietrich, who's done nothing, was not aware of all of this trouble and expense, and cannot.
But should you prevail here, what kind of opinion you think this court should write? What should we say?
I think you ought to make it clear that probably constructive trust was not applicable in this case, because I don't think there's anything wrong unless Fred did tout somebody, which there's never been any indication that he did. And if you make a division and you allow what was an illegal division at the time to exist, you better maybe make it clear that every attorney is not going to start putting in things that are contrary to the law now, because 6 or 8 or 10 years later it may change, and then the widow gets sued.
What does your client have to pay? Anything?
She's going to have to pay taxes. She's going to...
I want to know what kind of order we would give. If you want the Court of Appeals affirmed, then the Court of Appeals said constructive trust. She gets half with appreciation interest till 1995 and nothing thereafter.
If
Is that the decision you're asking us to affirm?
To affirm that part would be fine with me.
But what aren't we
because
affirming?
That's more than fair, as far as I'm concerned, to Sulzer. I think the matter has to be remanded for a recalculation because of the death coming before age 50, which...
Okay, and how is she going to pay? Is she going to pay immediately?
I have no idea.
Well, we have to issue an order. Do we say you pay immediately or you're subject to interest, you're subject to appreciation? I mean, what kind of order do you want?
I think that... I don't know how, I'm just trying to remember how she can get the funds out without, I know she has to pay taxes on them. The court is suggesting that they take away also her many options. It would either be pay the legal interest, 5 or 6%, whatever it is.
I take it she has control of this money right now, both the pension as well as the deferred comp.
To the best of my knowledge, she does, yes. So... Those calculations would have to be redone.
Can she borrow against them?
I'm sorry?
Can she borrow against these funds?
No. They're not assignable, apparently not assignable even yet. And the department is not a party to this action, so we really have no control over them. They're free to do what they want to do.
Okay.
So what all I'm asking is that something be done that is equitable to her also. She's been through a great deal just for having married Fred and going through this process. And there was no way she could calculate or convince the other party to what to take or what she's owed or not to be owed. She just had to go along. Even now we're arguing about what sum of money is correct to give to Mrs.
How much
Sullivan.
Money are we talking about? What was 50% worth at the time of the divorce?
I don't recall exactly. Copeland was worth hardly anything, the Wisconsin Retirement Fund. We have the papers in there as part of the exhibits.
Okay. What's it worth now with appreciation and interest, one half of it?
I believe Judge Hassan had calculated it at around $159,000, if I remember right.
The pension or the deferred comp?
That's total together. Yeah, between the Copeland Fund, which is now Citicorp, which is not even, it's not even Copeland anymore, it's Citicorp, and the Wisconsin Retirement Fund, I believe their expert had calculated that sum of money. But that did not take into consideration that they were talking about not taking his contributions. Well, his contributions have changed by reason of the death.
How could it be only $159,000 because the Court of Appeals awarded Ms. Sulzer $169,000, didn't they? Or do I have the
Court of Appeals? No, I don't believe so. I think they just set a date.
The circuit judge, I think that was...
Judge Hassan calculated.
The circuit judge did that.
Yes.
But he awarded Ms. Sulzer more than there is in the pot?
I'm sorry?
He awarded her more than is in the pot?
No.
The two pots?
No. That was what the number came out at that time before the funds depreciated in value and also before it was calculated, taken out of the contributions that Fred himself made. There was a built-in calculation, but the calculation that should have been in there is that he wasn't eligible for all the money that everybody thought he was because he died at 49 instead of 50.
Mr. Brendel, why was there such a long delay between the time litigation was started, I think it was in 1996, and the judgment in 2000.
I'm not sure. I was not a party to it at that time. I just came in the last year and a half or so. So what happened in between there, I know that from my record of reading of the record, it was primarily caused by Mrs. Sulzer's delay or the court. In one case, the court heard arguments by the two of us and then decided it was none of his business. He was leaving the bench, and so we wound up with a different judge. There was no decision made other than the decision is that that's not my problem, and so that caused some delay. Certainly we have not attempted to delay in any way.
I'm having a little difficulty. The result would be terribly harsh if your first position that everything in 1989 was invalid if we ratified that. But once you begin to make concessions about a constructive trust, and well, once you begin to make concessions, where do you stop? Why shouldn't we then apply the interest and appreciation as per the Washington case?
I don't know that the two of them are mixed. Constructive trust simply takes the matter away from the Wisconsin Retirement Fund people and transfers it to her because she's still here and has some of the money, just like the Boys and Girls Club of America had the money. That's a device in order to make her do something, which she shouldn't be before this court, really. And that there was no respectable or real reason, I believe, that there should have been at the time the quadro rule had not even been changed. And we're already 2 years into the lawsuit. Whether or not this was, if this was a contract, then her obligation was to go against the estate, which she did, Sulzer. And then she decided to dismiss it against the estate. I was not a party to that at the time either, so I don't know what the details were. But I do know that was dismissed. And her action, if there's any wrongdoing by Fred, her action is against Fred. And something should have been done a long time since the time that he died and between the time the law changed in 98 and all of this has been going on ever since. But she chose to do nothing. You'd think when she got the review and the decisions from the Wisconsin Retirement Fund and from Copeland, saying very plainly and clearly, you can't get here. We can't give you any money. There has to, you got to do something else, or you can appeal us. And she chose to do neither. And so here we are. But I don't think the two of them are together. I still think that if the law says this should not be done, it's against the law to start you jumping on my fireman's fringe benefits, that's the way the law should have been obeyed. And if there was a mistake, that was it. It was perhaps a mutual mistake. But that's what they intended at the, that's what I know Fred intended at the time. You can have this money. Let's just go on our way. And Judge Zick and his orders that were prepared, no doubt by plaintiff's counsel at the time, all seemed to indicate this is what we think you're to get. They even gave 6% interest on the money on the one that was directed, that I think you referred to earlier, indicating to me at least that the parties, the judge, the attorneys who drafted it, all thought she's entitled to that set amount, and at the very most 6% interest, which was 1%, I think, over what the statutory interest was at the time. But it looks to me like that's what the parties intended. They just wanted to go on their separate ways, as I mentioned before. I can't imagine in my wildest dream that after this divorce, Fred would want to wake 20 or 30 years later and start dishing out checks to his ex-wife. He believed that she could get it, get the money, I don't care, I'm going on with my life.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hausman.
Justices, candidly, in 36 years, I have never seen a fact situation like this case. I have the distinct pleasure of being on this case since 1996 when I started the original lawsuit. Mr. Brendel was the third attorney, if I remember correctly, on this case. I might be wrong. Might have been the second. And to get to the point as fast as I can, the Court of Appeals hit a home run and somebody died between third base and home. That's what happened in this case. The Court of Appeals said, we agree there's a constructive trust here. It met all the elements, as Justice Bradley said. The elements are all here. We can't turn our face aside to say Mrs. Sulzer's not to get anything. What's going on here? The fact of the matter is these two people in open court agreed to divide this plan. Everybody agreed to do it but one guy, Fred. Fred decided to take a right turn somewhere and not do what the court ordered him to do. Then we have the problem of a legislature that writes bills that says you can't do this to this, and then we have the people at Wisconsin Retirement, which in all my days when I wrote a letter to them and I'm told we don't have to pay attention to this court order, goodbye, it gets a little frustrating. So the lawsuit started. But the fact of the matter is this, as several of you have said, what is the fair thing to do? We can sit here and look at the pea and the shell game all day long, but the fair thing to do here is quite simple. We know that if you look at this as being, as I like to say it, it's like we have one amoeba, and on the day of the divorce, we split it into two amoebas. Each had one cell. And then one cell over here for Fred kept on getting fed, and it kept on growing because of benefits being paid into it. The other amoeba just sat here and grew on its own investment experience because nothing more was being fed into it. Now, Fred, who doesn't do what the court ordered him to do, has his ex-wife go file orders to try to get it done, but nobody will listen. Then Fred goes and dies, and all of a sudden, somebody finds out that, gee, I wasn't named anything. Everything went to my new wife. There's the problem.
Can I interrupt you for a moment?
Sure.
That amoeba on your left hand
right.
is the one that we're talking about here, right?
Right.
Okay. And what was the value of that as of the date of the divorce?
If I recall correctly, there's never a dollar amount set here. It says to be equally divided.
As of the value of the date of the divorce.
On the
so
date of the...
we need that number to determine what the parties intended, and then we need the investment experience of those funds between the date of the divorce and the date of death.
Correct. And all of that
starting point.
All of that is set forth in the exhibits that were done by the expert that we had, the attorney that we had testify on this without challenge, taking the experience right from that time. That's why I like using the term investment experience. This idea of interest and principal and all the rest is really misleading. There's an investment experience here in this amoeba in my left hand.
Right, and how much was that amoeba appreciating during that time period?
I believe it went from $27,000, which was the total amount in the ball here before it decided to become two amoebas, and it went up to about $170,000.
That was appreciation only. That's not continued contributions.
This is all on dividing out her share taken here and growing on investment experience. The goods and the bads, up till I think it was 1999, I'm sorry, when we went to trial in 2000 and presented the evidence, it was around $169,000 or $170,000.
Her share,
that's correct.
Share.
Without doing anything to this side of the investment experience and the additional contributions being made. Nothing had happened. All of this that we're discussing today is, I mean, this can get so complicated, but it is not that complicated.
Is there any need to remand this case for a determination, as your opposing counsel indicates, with regard to benefits because he died before age 50? Does that enter into this at all?
I don't feel qualified to answer that because I don't know the answer, but I do know this. From my experience with the Wisconsin Retirement Trust, something's got to be remanded to the trial court and be told to issue an order that a lump sum payment be directed, be paid to Mary Diedrich. Have her ask for
a lump sum. Hold it. Are you asking us to issue an order that is contrary to law? Doesn't the statute, I don't know the answer to this, but it seems to me that the statutes provide that the ETF shall pay to the beneficiary and doesn't have any discretion. Then that's the position of ETF, that, hey, we can't pay to anyone, have to follow the statutes.
I think you misunderstood what I said. What I was saying was this, that the trial court order Mary Diedrich to have money paid to her.
Okay.
And then, to make it correct, as we said in the trial court, discount the tax effect of it because it's not fair. It's not Mary's problem.
So it's your position, even if you prevail, this matter has to be remanded for the appropriate calculations, which take into account what?
It takes into account nothing different than what we did at the time of trial, which shows the continued investment experience on her share, up or down.
Does it take into account what your opposing counsel indicated about he died before age 50?
Yes, it does.
And that wasn't before the trial court when this case was decided in 2001.
I can't answer that. I've forgotten that. I do not remember if the death experience was in there. We all knew that he had died, you know, before 50. In fact, it was like a week or 2 weeks.
Your amoeba actually is divided in two pots, isn't it?
The correct.
As well as the deferred comp.
That is correct.
Now, are you saying that the total of the two pots is 100? Your expert said 170,000.
That's correct.
Well, that's not too far off from what the Court of Appeals gave you.
That's correct. That's correct. Judge Hassan, when he computed it out, was working with her calculations. There was no other calculation to work with. That was it.
What the Court of Appeals give you?
Court of Appeals gave us 61,000, I think it was, and they said that's what we calculated on your calculations that our expert said, but your expert would say it's only now worth 62,000 because we're only going to give it to you to the date of death.
But we could use those figures instead of remanding it back?
No, because unfortunately we have to finish the story. It only ended in 2000. We have to get an update for the next 2.5 years,
right,
which would take about 5 minutes.
That's right, but that's the answer I wanted. In other words, there's no doubt here that this has to be, somebody has to do it, this court, unless we get a master or somebody to figure it out. We can't do it.
I can tell you this, Justice, that I did talk to the expert, Attorney Becker, and she told me I can calculate that difference in that leap in about 3 minutes. That's all it takes. Give me the two statements for the years 2001, 2002, and she takes the figures like she did in every other year and can calculate what it is, the good and the bad.
So we can tell the trial court what to do, but you could take that and sit down with Mr. Bendel and figure it out in 2 minutes.
I'm not sure I could take that leap. I'm not sure I can take that leap.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Hausman, and thank you, Mr. Brindell, and thank you, Mr. Jelinek, for your arguments today. But before we call a halt, let me introduce some guests. We have Professor Itsuko Matsura with us today from Japan, and she has guests. Would you introduce your guests? We're delighted to have you all with us. Thank you. That we are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.